The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their articles from the latest issue. This week we'll be hearing from Charlotte Eager, who is a producer of the Trojan Women Project who works with Syrian refugees, about why refugees need to be given more jobs. Then we'll be joined by Lionel Shriver, who asks whether or not she's alone in not wanting to download the COVID app. And finally, Tom O in defence of B-Days. First, it's Charlotte Eager.
The Alpha Migrants by Charlotte Eager. We're all slowly becoming aware that there's a new migrant crisis. Last week, John Donison of the BBC, cruising the English Channel looking for asylum seekers heading to the UK, found four young men paddling by hand their tiny rubber dinghy. They'd come from Sudan via France, and for the last leg of their journey, they'd dodged the oil tankers and the container ships, ploughing the world's busiest shipping lane. Only one of the young men even wore a life jacket. They'd come from Sudan via France, and for the last leg of their journey, they'd dodged the oil tankers and container ships, ploughing the world's busiest shipping lane. Only one of the young men even wore a life jacket. These were the latest of more than 9,000 people who have risked their lives to arrive by sea this year. The other story of the summer is the shortage of labour. Desperate farmers are being forced to leave vegetables rotting in the fields for want of pickers and packers. Haulage companies report a shortage of lorry drivers. Restaurants just reopened post-COVID are closing again for lack of staff. So why can't we put two and two together? If we urgently need pickers and sorters, waiters and chefs, if agriculture and hospitality depend on labour they can't now find, why not let asylum seekers do those jobs? This is not as odd an idea as it sounds. I've met a lot of illegal immigrants over the past 8 years, working with a therapeutic advocacy project for Syrian refugees, the Trojan Women Project, and I can promise you that these are impressive and hard-working people. Without exception, in my experience, anyone who can walk for days, negotiate with people traffickers, survive the journey across the Aegean in an overloaded rubber boat, dodge the Turkish and Greek coast guards, hitchhike it through Europe and then go another 500 miles and smuggle themselves into the UK by lorry or boat. They are exceptional. You'd want them on your team. We call them the Alpha Migrants. Yet they are forbidden to work until they get their leave to remain and their refugee status. I find this bewildering, and so do they. It's no-brainer asking asylum seekers to do those jobs, said Rafiq, 33, who came to Britain in 2015 from Syria by boat and lorry. The journey had cost him $15,000, which he'd saved by working as an interpreter in Iraq. My 11 months of waiting by the postbox in my hostel for the letter from the Home Office was the most miserable time of my life, he said. Awa, a 35-year-old actress, agrees. I just volunteered for everything, she said. I was so bored and lonely. Awa was quite famous in Syria before the war. Then ISIS invaded her hometown, Yarmouk, and she set off to escape, walking from Syria through Turkey into Greece with the help of smugglers whom she had to pay $5,000. From Corfu, she flew here on a US passport she bought for €550. Many who are sympathetic to migrants nonetheless think it best if they stay in or near their home country. The economist Paul Collier has made this case in this magazine. Western economies should subsidise camps and factories in Jordan or Turkey for Syrian refugees, so the argument goes, to deter desperate people from paying smugglers for expensive and dangerous journeys. These proximate havens also ensure that countries such as Syria or Lebanon aren't drained of their brightest and best workers. Now yes, proximate havens are effective for some. Many refugees are happy to stay in countries where they know the language, where, when the war finally ends, they are a bus ride from home. But those who arrive across the Channel, the migrants I've met, they don't want to work in factories, particularly not in countries where there is no hope of citizenship or rights. Where it's impossible for them to earn enough to put their children through university, the classic route out of poverty. Take Leila, for example. Her husband was a doctor in their native Syria. After the war started, the family fled to Turkey, but the only job he could get was in a razor factory. After a year, in 2015, they took a boat to Lesbos and hiked to Germany. Leyla's only luggage was her handbag and her three-month-old baby. In Germany, her husband re-qualified and he's now a doctor near Leipzig. Should he really have stayed in the razor factory? Most of the alpha migrants we've met are middle class, either young men like Rafik, fleeing war or conscription, or families like Leyla's, investing their dwindling resources into a future for their children. The Sudanese and Iranians are fleeing persecution and their own chaotic economies. But if you give them a chance, they'll study, they'll re-qualify and they'll work. One young Syrian I know, Ahmed, paid $2,000 to come here by boat, lorry and on foot in 2016. He would love to return to his parents and his life in Damascus, but he'd be forced to fight. He is now reading computer science at Strathclyde University and working for a gaming company. We're never going to be able to stop these resourceful people getting into boats to flee war zones. And they're not going to stay in France, where mostly they say they've been badly harassed by the police. They come to the UK because, says Ahmed, it's less racist. That is the experience for the migrants who've already arrived here. And I believe we should take advantage of these bright, brave people. We don't have to worry about being overwhelmed. Callous though it sounds, the current process, whereby people cross in boats, that restricts the numbers because it's dangerous and expensive. There have been jobs for decades that no Britons want to do, and because our welfare state provides enough to survive, they don't have to. We have traditionally filled that gap with workers from abroad, once from the Commonwealth and more recently from Eastern Europe. Why not employ the people landing on our shores? We could make it part of the asylum process. Working could speed up their claims. It would have to be organised. We don't want a Roman-style slave market on the docks. And of course, fruit picking, waitering and lorry driving, they're not why alpha migrants are here. But it's a job and it's a start. Migrants have often done manual jobs in the hopes their children will become doctors. After all, Priti Patel's parents were refugees from Uganda. They ran a newsagent, and look where it's got her.
That was Charlotte Eager. Now it's Lionel Shriver.
Am I alone in not wanting to download the COVID app? By Lionel Shriver. As I begin, I'm tortured by the doo-doo-doo-doo of the Twilight Zone's theme music. I've hurtled back in time. Suddenly, I'm a wise-ass, liberty-loving journalist who's had it up to my eyeballs with intrusive, ineffectual, top-down nannyism. And I'm pooping on yet another pitiful feint at doing something by the lumbering big state. Okay, check. This feels dead familiar. But I went to a poncier school. My hair is way weirder. And it seems that my name is Boris Johnson. Consider this, then, an act of either plagiarism or ventriloquism. If with a tad more alliteration, I'm keener on assonance myself. Boris of a few years back would have written this very column in The Spectator. The proposition that to improve the UK's fat stats, we all download a government app that tracks our supermarket purchases and daily exercise, or lack thereof, purely in the hopes that for fewer calories in and more calories out, we'll earn loyalty points, which can be exchanged for shop discounts and free concert tickets. Well, that's just the sort of clumsy micromanaging that before Boris would have mercilessly pilloried. Yet this is the very anti-obesity strategy that born-again Boris proposes to trial in January. It's unsettling enough that the Tesco algorithm is now clued up on my immoderate fondness for fine green beans. Do I really want to confess to central government my seditious attachment to French butter? Now that whether we hold our own mother's hand is the government's business, I guess Boris Johnson wedging uncomfortably into the child seat of my supermarket trolley was only a matter of time. Presumably the intention is to weaponize kids. "Please don't buy that Cadbury milk bar, Mom," the urchins will plead. "It'll cost us 7 points. If you get broccoli instead, we've almost enough points to see Beyoncé in October." Really. Even if parents are goaded to load up on more vegetables, Brits presently throw away 2.5 billion pounds worth of veg every year. Should we nudge that to 3 billion then? Unless the NHS installs cameras in our kitchens, though I'm loath to give these people ideas. For that matter, wily shoppers could scan the carrots on the app and snag the chocolate with cash. As for the exercise bit, our overlords clearly imagined the lot of us getting cheerfully caught up in a healthy nationwide competition over how many steps we've logged and miles we've jogged, although I'm sorry to report that those Fitbit gizmos can't record miles cycled or swum. We'll joyously celebrate high achievers who'll get written up in Telegraph features, a la Captain Tom. It'll be one big jocular communitarian frenzy, a sports day all year long. Except, you know what? We're competitive about exercise anyway. Too competitive, if you're one of those sorts. Should you be unsusceptible to the current social pressure that fills costly private gyms with energizer bunnies, you're apt to figure out how to get your step count up by shaking your smartphone on the sofa while watching the second season of Manifest. For were our loyalty points to deliver truly tantalizing rewards? Doubtful. Personally, I'd pay not to go to pop concerts. This app will be a dawdle to game. Shall we consider what already incentivizes us to eat sensibly, keep our weight down, and regularly get our blood running? The lower risk of cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. The social stigma that attaches to fat and sloth. The social status that attaches to skinniness and athleticism. The seductive promise of a longer life and less pain and disability in old age. The fact that obesity massively increases the likelihood of hospitalization and/or death from a certain respiratory virus that's got rather a lot of play lately. All that motivation, threats of early demise, private and public opprobrium, and hellish physical suffering, is not enough, apparently, to keep 2/3 of Britons from being overweight. So what's bound to do the trick at last? A 10% discount on a t-shirt. This initiative is disturbing not only for its inevitable inefficacy and subsequent waste of public resources. The Fat App is driven by the same impulses that turned an unfortunate pandemic into an excuse for nearly total government dominion over the most intimate, granular aspects of our lives. Now that we've abdicated responsibility for our health to Westminster, nothing stops them from refusing us admittance to a nightclub because we ate a piece of chocolate cake, or denying us the privilege of entertainment because we didn't churn miserably on a stationary bike first. Whatever the answer to obesity is, it doesn't lie with government. In resorting to a trendily high-tech pseudo-solution that would lodge the contents of our supermarket shops in a Whitehall computer, this administration displays a positively Chinese appetite for social control. But please, while we're on the subject of apps, downloading the NHS COVID contact tracing app is not a legal requirement. In the current pingdemic, that manic digital monstrosity is confining millions to self-isolation, the vast majority of whom are not sick and aren't contagious with anything other than boredom and claustrophobia. This Bluetoothed boogeyman is of dubious epidemiological value because, just like a lockdown, it overwhelmingly confines the healthy. Yet businesses with insufficient staff are being brought to their knees at the very time the economy is meant to be recovering. Public services are calcifying. Given the law of 6 degrees of separation, the entire population could soon be pinged into suspended animation. Can someone explain to me then, why do so many people have this thing on their phones? Why does anyone? For that matter, the ping to self-isolate is a stern recommendation, but not a legal obligation. Why do all you people comply with these edicts anyway? Do I, as an uncomprehending American, simply lack the one-for-all and all-for-one gene? Why download an app that can ruin your life? If you've got it, delete it. If you're pinged, ignore it. Go to bleeding work. For the sake of the nation, stop being so ever-loving obedient. Is that so hard?
That was Lionel Shriver, and finally, Tom O.
In December 2019, and in keeping with our tradition of perverse birthday gifts, some friends gave me a bidet device. The contraption was a simple one. Fastened onto the back of the lavatory bowl beneath the rim of the seat, it plugs into the flexible hose that filled the cistern, thus enabling the user to administer a cool jet of water of variable angle and intensity via the control panel at their right hand. Back then, like most Britons, I saw bidets as a humorous oddity. Then, a few months later, coronavirus reached our shores. Hygiene became a matter of life and death, and supermarkets sold out of loo paper. In these unlikely circumstances, our unwanted plug-and-play bidet became a welcome member of the household. Among the world's developed nations, we British are anomalous. Since the bidet's invention in pre-revolutionary France, it has become de rigueur in well-maintained bathrooms on the continent, in the Middle East, in much of South America, and of course in Japan. Typically incorporated into lavatory bowls rather than being separate, the high-tech Japanese incarnations offer variable water temperature, adjustable seat temperature, noise-masking music, and much else. So why not here? Fashions for household goods move in mysterious ways, but the conventional telling is that, in an era where Britain and France were at each other's throats, bidets aggravated not only the prudishness of the British, but our francophobia. Long after the War of Independence, this attitude prevailed in the United States. In the Second World War, Allied soldiers came across bidets in European brothels, but perhaps understandably, they chose not to replicate this bathroom furniture when they returned home. Thus, in film and TV, English-speaking characters are foxed by bidets. Examples include Mick Crocodile Dundee, transplanted to New York in the 1986 film, and Homer Simpson, visiting Japan in 1999. Bidets are the butt of many jokes. Yet the jokes might not endure. Bidets are becoming more common both here and in the States. The plumber who helped install my own retrofit bidet told me that he had recently done several such jobs in West London, and the trend seems to be nationwide. Tom Reynolds, chief executive of the Bathroom Manufacturers Association, says fixtures that combine the functionality of bidets and lavatories have been picking up in sales. He added, "These smart loos have been gaining popularity in recent years, and we may now have reached a tipping point where they are a more mainstream choice." Meanwhile, the Tokyo Olympics offers bidets a more salubrious showcase than wartime brothels, especially since Japanese manufacturers made an agreement in 2017 to simplify and universalize their controls. A few months ago, I moved out of the flat with a retrofit bidet, which was too entangled with the plumbing for me to extract it. The new place came with the rather elegant standalone version, and I was delighted. I will never again look back.
That was Tom O. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. And if you like this podcast, do leave us a review or a rating. And remember, join us again next time. Thanks for listening.